church.
Thank you for helping.
All right, good morning. I'll call to order the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting for this Tuesday, February 13th. One shopping day left until Valentine's Day for everybody. And ask if you please join the board as we honor America with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, thank you and good morning. First item on our agenda, as always, is public comment number one. It's an opportunity for members of the public to address topics on today's agenda or really anything you'd like to address. If there's anybody wishing to do so, please come on up. And seeing no one moving immediately, the microphone, we'll move on. Agency reports is the first item today. And we've got CCJ here. Craig?
Thank you.
Good morning.
How are you?
You're doing really well. Hope you're doing well.
I don't hope it's not significant. You invited me here on Fat Tuesday.
Where's the bees?
We'll bring it in. I'm Craig Evans. I'm the Executive Director for the Center of Creative Justice in Ames. We're a community-based nonprofit, a private nonprofit agency. We provide correctional supervision to adult criminal offenders that have been placed on probation by the local judiciary. We've been in existence since 1974, more than 40 years. We're mostly assigned misdemeanor offenders. That frees up the Iowa Department of Corrections to supervise felons, and of course they do parolees. The vast majority of our clients come from almost exclusively from Story County and Ames. The courts represent the local community. We believe the courts rely heavily on our services to provide an important sentencing option. In fact, supervise about three-fourths of the individuals placed on probation in Story County each year. Our overall caseload, at the time I noted this, was about 655. We think our services are important in the community. We kind of try to accomplish two broad goals, rehabilitation of the offender and protection of the community from commission of further criminal offenses. We think our services are effective. The kind of two broad measures we utilize are success rate and recidivism, non-recidivism. And those are the two items we also report for the clear impact scorecard with the United Way. In 2017, our success rate was around 90%. 90% of people placed on probation successfully completed it. And 94% of the clients we supervise that completed their probation did not reoffend within the following year. We're very pleased with both of those numbers. Clients we supervise work toward a number of goals to try to assist them in successfully completing community supervision. Since I was here last year, we've added an anger management program that we didn't have that we're offering this year to try to help community members deal with anger issues. It's not, of course, the state also operates the Iowa Domestic Abuse Program. This isn't for people convicted of domestic abuse, but people, we've seen an uptick in people convicted of other kinds of assaulted cases. And so we're offering that service. Our clients also are referred for substance abuse assessment and treatment if it's indicated, mental health assessment and treatment, drinking driver's school, of course, the anger management program, the Iowa Domestic Abuse Program, a large percentage of our assaulted cases are actually for domestic abuse. Also, payment of victim restitution, court costs, completing financial obligations such as that. We think keeping people in the community on probation makes financial sense. It's quite a bit cheaper than incarcerating someone in jail or one of the state penal institutions. It also allows the offender to remain in the community where they have access to, especially here in Story County, a lot of resources that they can avail themselves of, as well as stay with their family, work, that sort of thing. So just kind of summarize briefly, we think we're a cost-effective, results-oriented community option for working with adult criminal offenders here in Story County. We think reducing criminal conduct has a broad impact and a widespread impact on the entire community. Fewer tax dollars are expended. Investigating, prosecuting offenders, of course, victimization hopefully is reduced. We think our programming has a positive ripple effect throughout the entire community, that offenders, if they participate in the programming and successfully complete probation, attend substance abuse treatment, stop drinking or using drugs, they become employed, are able to pay for their debts and take care of the family. We think if they obtain anger management, if that's been an issue, mental health treatment, take responsibility for their actions, and overall the community's, you know, vastly improved, and that the services we provide directly to the offender have kind of a ripple, positive ripple effect throughout the entire community. That's kind of us in a nutshell. We certainly appreciate the support that Story County provides to us, as well as the rest of the asset funders.
Well, it's even support, Greg. I mean, what you guys do. So underscore, you touched on it earlier, you were talking. Underscore how unique CCJ in Story County is when we compare it really anywhere else in Iowa or really in the Midwest. What you guys do and how you do it.
Yeah, there's very few, to my knowledge. We've never been able to find any other private nonprofits that do this anywhere outside of Iowa. There's a smaller agency in Boone called Boone County. Well, they changed their name recently. It was Boone County Prevention and Community Service. I think they just call themselves Boone County Probation now. But the only two agencies, I believe, in Iowa that provide this service. I always felt it was a valuable service. I've only personally been at CCJ about 10 years, but I spent a long time working for the State Department of Corrections, and we always valued the services that allowed us to focus on high-risk offenders and parolees. We also had a much higher success rate than the rest of the state at that time in terms of people completing the average domestic abuse. There was a call back then, the Batterers Education Program, because clients were supervised by CCJ. A lot of the offenders, domestic violence, simple assault, public intox, theft tip, all of those are simple misdemeanors, and by code, the State Department can't supervise those cases. Here in Story County, they get supervised, so their success rates are much higher than in other counties where they're not.
Absolutely, and it also seems to be, from everything I've read, that your success rate, when we look at recidivism, seems to be much higher than others providing services like you.
I believe that to be the case. Now, part of it is we do, by nature, work with a somewhat lower risk, lower classification of offender. Most of them are misdemeanors, although our risk, right now, over half our clients are using the same classification that State Department of Corrections uses. They're classified moderate to high risk. But we have a very good success rate. Our recidivism rates very well. We only measure out a year. That's traditionally what they've done. I've been looking at maybe moving, bumping that out. It's a very cumbersome process for us and very time-intensive to do that. Recidivism research in terms of looking through the Iowa courts online to ascertain whether someone's been convicted of a new offense within that period. So we're looking, though, to bump out to maybe do both 12 and 18. We'll see where we go from there. But at 12, we have a very high, very low recidivism rate.
Craig, with 655 clients right now, active clients, are you at the max you can handle, or do you have capacity yet?
I think we've passed another 655 are total cases, so there are a number of cases that aren't, so when you say active, they're not actively being supervised because they're on a warrant status or maybe have absconded, but they're still clients. Probably our active number is more in the 500 range. We do have capacity to expand. We've done some different things. I carry a caseload myself, so I have almost about 75 cases. Our office manager carries cases, so we have some leeway there. We also had some part-time, before I was asked to become director, I was part-time. I didn't fill that position, so that's still an empty position. We conceivably could bring on more staff if we need to. We have some room right now, headroom within what we have.
Marty? No, I have nothing other than Greg, thanks for coming to talk to us today. But as you sit there and look at your recidivism, it's 94% of the clients successfully completed the probation did not reoffend. Would it be a hardship on you and your organization just to extend that timeline out as far, you know, the 1 year, 2 year, 3 year? So I mean, a really good, a snapshot reflects those people that just transitioned out of your view. But I mean, just to see, as we have pretty much a finite pool of people, and I would just like to see where that goes. In the sense that if somebody's really turned the corner, they've had the opportunity extended to you by your organization to avail themselves of all the services we have in Story County, just what their success looks like past 1 year.
Well, the hardship would be the time that it would take to actually do the research, so to speak. I talked to a couple of people at Iowa State. I think 18 months is what they kind of consider an ideal time frame to look at for recidivism. I don't know where they gather that number from. That's just what they have told me. Okay. The problem is that it just takes more time. We have to literally manually sift through court records to see who's been convicted or not convicted of offenses. And so that's been one of the drawbacks. Obviously, the rate would probably change the longer out you look. The more people would probably have recidivated. I don't know percentage-wise where that would fall, but we're looking at maybe doing that this year when we do it, depending on how much time we have and what staff availability we have.
Other than that, like what I say, thank you.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks for your support. We really appreciate it.
Next is overview of proposed real estate record scanning. Lucy, and I don't know Kimberly.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Good morning.
For the Flat Systems.
Once you sit down, Kimberly, reintroduce yourself so that we have it for the record.
I'm Kimberly Tarpey with COT Systems. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. As a result of the budget work session, I had asked for funding in FY19 for land record scanning, and the board had asked if we could move that up to the current year. So today is just an overview for you to ask questions. I plan to bring this as an action item next week. And I just wanted to, I brought some visual aids here. This is one of our original plat books. The auditor's office is a repository of a lot of original records, permanent records. So in terms of if you ever come into the auditor's office, we have approximately like 75 books that look like this, that weigh this much. And they're bound in a variety of different ways. But and this has actual the originals from platting, so the maps of the what Story County looked like when it was first created. They said these are original documents. This is the copy that we have, and COT has an excellent track record of coming into Iowa counties and scanning these books. I mean, for me, just to put this on our copier and make a PDF, it's no good unless it's indexed and people can and search it properly. So some questions that you had during my budget work session were about the process, how that's done. COT offers this on-site, which I really like because I don't want these to leave my custody. And also in terms of disaster recovery, if anything catastrophic were ever to happen to this building, I say the joke goes, like, everyone grab a transfer book and a drainage map, which is kind of a joke, but kind of isn't, because this is what we have. And Kimberly has some great horror stories about jurisdictions that have had to recreate these records and what that costs. So I brought her in today to answer specific questions about the process and also about the ongoing maintenance of these records, if you have them. And then, again, I'll bring this to the action item for next week because it is unbudgeted. I wanted you to have as much information as possible.
So, Kimberly, thank you so much for being here. Just lay out for us, assuming that we enter into this agreement for you to come in, just talk us through what is the process is going to look like from beginning to end as you guys come in.
Very well, and thank you for having me this morning. As Lucy had mentioned, we have done similar type projects here in Iowa for a number of counties, one being your neighbor, Jasper County, the auditor's office there, as well as the recorder's office. And just briefly, how this would work is COT has been in the land records business for 130 years. So I'm very fortunate that I work with a group of people who are truly experts in these records. So what we do is we bring out the necessary equipment and staff to the location, and our staff digitizes the images. From that standpoint, it moves on to another group of experts within the organization who organize the information. Instead of having to re-index everything, what we're going to do is virtually replicate how you would search for a record in Lucy's office today. You'll be able to do that exact process on a computer. So we have people who are, again, intimately familiar with land records who organize that. Then from there, we have a group of experts who actually build the search process that Lucy was referring to so that ultimately accurate search results are rendered. Then once that whole process is completed, we do go through a quality control process internally, make it available to the office holder and their staff and anybody else who they might wish to partake in kind of going through things, and then the system is launched.
Very good. Question for us.
So, Lucy, how would, after this would be done, would it be, how was your office, because you're still going to get walk-ins and people are going to want to know on a research basis, how is that going to differ for the public?
We actually still write in our transfer books. This is a flat book, but so there'll be a bright line where we'll say that our transfer books, you can still walk in and use those up to X date. Mm-hmm. But then after that, when we went with Tyler, we have an electronic transfer book there. So after a certain point, those that you would be able to refer to the books, you'd have to refer to the Tyler system, and we have public terminals for that that people can use if they want to do that search. So we wouldn't get rid of our flat tables, we wouldn't get rid of our books. You know, if somebody came in and the power was out, you could still do a search by flashlight. But mostly we will go from writing in our transfer books, which we still do. I think we will continue to write on our plat maps. We're not having those digitized. We're having our historical plat maps digitized instead. So you would either come in and look at a book or you would come in and look at a terminal. So, yes, walk-ins are still welcome. And sometimes people want to lay hands on an original document. So.
All right.
How did we end up choosing Cox's?
No, I can I can have two quotes, which I did, and so the reason I'm choosing COT is because they come on site. I don't have to let things go off site. So, yeah. And I talked to my fellow auditors. I talked to Stacey Herridge about who I go to conferences, and there's always land records people there. So I've talked to them over the years. So.
So what is the length of time for this process when you come here?
You know, it does vary. I did share with Lucy that how this will work is depending on what dates would be convenient for her schedule, our staff will coordinate with her. From start to finish, it will be months. If instead that data was ever to be reindexed, that takes years. So this process is much shorter. I would say 3 to 6 months maximum.
But just the scanning portion.
I'm sorry. I spoke with Lucy this morning, and again, our staff, once here on site, will work as many minutes and hours as Lucy and the staff will permit. But I'll estimate maybe 2 or 3 weeks maximum. Again, taking the books apart, reassembling them, digitizing everything, make sure everything is inventoried.
Super. And what kind of space do we need to allocate for your equipment and your staff coming in to do it?
Actually, Lucy was showing me this morning the space actually where the books are kept today is sufficient for what we'll need. We will be bringing in a big machine because some of those books don't come apart. They're not mechanical. They're actually stitch-bound. Mm-hmm. So there's ample space where Lucy could accommodate our staff to do this.
Yep.
Which, of course, makes the process even faster because we're not taking books to another area. So,
if the machine fits in the elevator, does it come apart?
No. Yes, it does. And actually, we use the elevator over at the Jasper County Courthouse. I'm confident that we shouldn't have an issue here either.
Good.
So, Lucy, will these records then be accessible for me from a remote location then through our
just through a web connection.
Okay, through a web connection.
Yeah.
And is there do you have any concerns about that from an interface standpoint, or will it just be literally a link into separate? And I'm thinking about our new website refresh.
I think and Kimberly can speak more to this, but other counties, there's just a link on their site that you link to the COT system, and then it's a searchable system.
Yes, that's what most all counties here in Iowa that we've worked with, and we've been working with Iowa counties for many years, but most of the offices where we've completed these types of projects, what they elect to do is to have that link that sends the searcher externally out to the COT system. So, in other words, they're not coming into your infrastructure.
Sure. And so our information is stored and handled off-site in the COT system. So I would assume we've got a cost for you guys to come in and digitize everything and organize everything and get it ready. What are we looking at in terms of ongoing costs? And what happens if a great 130-year-old company someday, Story County is going to be around a long, long time. What happens if a company like COT goes away?
So what I would say to that is once the system is complete, and in the agreement it will state this, the data is always Story County's data.
Okay.
You're using COT's system, again, as far as the retrieval purposes go. So if something ever happened in the future, it's always Story County's data.
Right.
From a business continuity standpoint, this data will be in a Tier 4 data center without getting into all the bits and bytes. Essentially, that's top of the line for anybody who, you know, is somewhat technical. There is information about what that means within the copies of the proposal that we've prepared for Story County. So if it would ever be that COT, something happens, all of that data is still Story County's. You have the system. Included in this proposal is the ongoing monthly cost for using the Tier 4 data center and for COT to support the system. So that is all including what's been proposed.
It's like $150 a month, so about a little under
$2,000
a year.
Good.
And then coming back, because I really like to pay attention to the competitive process and the bid process. So the amount for the initial contract will cover everything. We're not staged, right, Lucy, by various parts. That on-site and what they do afterwards is all one package, correct? And then we jump right to the monthly.
Yeah, and I think what my budget proposal included the ongoing fee as well when I put it into my budget. So there is they did in their proposal build in a second phase, which I'm not asking for right now, which would include all of our paper drainage records, but that's a conversation for another day. This is sort of the meat and potatoes, these 75 books and the 200 maps that I want to get scanned. That's what people come in and look at every day. That's what I'm most afraid of losing in the event of a disaster.
Thank you.
Good. Other questions? So this will be an action item coming to us next week.
Yes.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Consideration of minutes from February 6th.
I would still move as presented.
Second.
Motion and a second. Olson.
Aye.
Chi.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Personnel actions as listed.
As presented.
Second.
Chi.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Consent agenda board.
I would move as presented.
Second.
Olson?
Aye.
Chi?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. We do have a public hearing item today, and that is consideration of Resolution 1876 to enter into a purchase agreement for the sale of county property known as Parcel P, a part of the former Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. Ethan and Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, long process this has been. Good job by both of you to get us here.
Long process indeed. But we're coming to the end, hopefully so. Last week, the board, we closed a transaction with Union Pacific to get the east 3/8 of Northwest Quarter, Section 21, 85 North, Range 21 West. And in that east 3/8, there's a small corner piece which we've identified as Parcel P. Is occupied by part of Zerion Fertilizer's building and parking lot. So what the board is doing here today is essentially making it right and giving them what their building sits on. In exchange, they're giving us an easement over the eastern part of their property so we can continue the trail. So today, the purchase agreement to approve that sale, the negotiated price was $1, so a nominal fee in exchange for easement for nominal fee of a dollar.
Dollar and a dollar. Board questions before we open the public hearing. I think that we've all been tracking on this as we try to get this done.
It's a painfully small piece of property that I think it was a shock to everybody involved that's been through negotiation that nobody owned it other than the railroad. Everybody thought the railroad had already passed it on, and it leads almost a year and a half later to this.
Yeah, no question.
Okay, this gets it all cleaned up, so we'll open the public hearing and ask if there's anybody who would like to address Resolution 1876. Seeing no one moving the microphone, we'll close the public hearing. Turn to the board for action.
I would move Resolution 1876 as presented.
I would second that.
Got a motion and a second for Resolution 1876. Any further discussion? Ethan, Mike, anything to add? Olson?
Aye.
Chitty?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Resolution 1876 passes. Thanks for you guys
being
on that.
Thank you. Appreciate what work you did on this.
Additional item, consideration of a memorandum of agreement between Iowa State University, City of Ames, Story County, and Story County 911 Service Board to fund professional services provided by Mission Critical Partners. So we discussed this and agreed to it in principle last week. Now we've got the actual contract in front of us. I don't think we need anybody to speak to us unless you guys have new questions from last week.
None.
If there are none, I'd take a motion to approve.
I would move consideration of the memorandum of agreement between Iowa State, City of Ames, Story County, and the Story County 911 Service Board for professional services provided by Mission Critical Partners for the process of designing and procuring a land mobile radio system for public safety and public services agencies for the cost of $134,924.
I would second that. Do we want to split? Would you welcome an amendment that splits out our costs also?
Well, you can
just note it. How about if you second? How about if you go ahead and note our cost?
Note our cost is $33,731.
One quarter of the total contract, and I'll just point out for everybody. So this is this is really the beginning of the beginning of a long process, right? It took us several years to get to the beginning. Now we're actually looking at where we're going from here in terms of what system we're building, exactly how we're going to pay for it. The estimate now is that it's something like an $8 million system, and this contract is going to help us get through the process of selecting the system and figuring out exactly who and how we're going to pay for everything. I would expect it to be about a year before we get to those final decisions, and then probably another 6 or 8 months in build-out before we talk about having this system up and operational, but it's a really important starting point. Anything else we need to know for the record today? Chief.
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. It passes, and board, so that we're all on the same page. So as I understand it, the Ames City Council has this as part of their agenda for tonight, in what I understand is going to be a marathon meeting for them. Iowa State is dealing with this, and E911 meets tomorrow night.
Right.
And so that's where we should be. Yeah.
And then it did mention in the memorandum that there are two separate groups working on this. So one appeared to be more of an executive-type decision-making group, and then one appeared to be more of a work group. So I'm asking who is representing us on each of those groups.
Yeah, so I think the working group is going to continue to be the same one that E911 put together, which will basically be the professionals in law enforcement and a few others. Marty Chitty has served us on as part of that group through the process. The second group that I believe is being referred to is kind of this this executive level group made up of Vice President of Iowa State and some staff members, the city manager and assistant city manager from Ames, me, and then I've been including Deb Shildroth so that we can get everything back. I don't imagine that that group's going to have a whole lot more to do. Our main focus was trying to get to the end of having this contract done, and then it'll be part of Mission Critical's purview to start to pull together all the decision-making bodies to try to ascertain how we move forward.
Okay, and then the attorneys will come in at some point, correct, to figure out how we actually put...
Yeah, so the attorneys have already been included in one meeting, and actually they worked together to produce this contract. And then absolutely, whether it's a 2080 or some kind of just contractual agreement, there will be something necessary when we get down to the funding of this. Lars, there's multiple options on how this thing could be funded. And ultimately, who's going to pay for it? I think it's reasonable to expect Story County to have somewhere between 25 and 33% of the total cost of the backbone, and then for Story County to be responsible for either the purchase or leasing of all of its handheld and mounted equipment. But we'll know that as we get through the process, exactly what that looks like as we get through the process.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that because we only get one vote on each of those groups, right? So then Marty would be our vote on the work group.
Well, no. This board is our vote. Now, so Marty would be able to work through with that group building a proposal that might have to come back to this body. I would be able to work through with that other group if there was some kind of proposal that was coming back, but it would proceed exactly like this one proceeded, where a group would be meeting to develop a proposal that then every decision-making body, the city council, us, whatever Iowa State's appropriate decision-making mechanism is, and then the E911 board would all have to deal on those independently.
Thank you.
That
That's very clear.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Huh? Sure. Anything else? Okay. We acted on that? Did we act on that, Shelley?
I would do it.
Do it again? All right. Chi.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Passes and we're in agreement. Next item is consideration of the purchase of a new 85-gallon water softener with installation and disposal of the old one. For $15,000, unbudgeted?
Unbudgeted.
Just hit the end of its life.
Yes.
Start by introducing yourself, Joey.
I'm Joby Brogdon, Director of Facilities Management.
Morning, Joby.
Good morning. Yeah, it's currently offline because when we run water through it, it's leaking out the drain about 3 to 5 gallons an hour. So we don't want that water bill. And it is a 15-year-old water softener put in shortly after that facility was built, about summer 2002. And according to Culligan, it was an old system when they installed it. It was stopped manufacturing it in 2004, I do believe. So we're at the point where parts are not available for it. So it's got the valve issue, seating valve issue, because the head of it's a brass piece of equipment, and so the valves, when it cycles through, they don't seat no more, and that valve body is no longer available for purchase. So we had to, at this point, bypass it, so we are currently not using soft water at the facility. And given the nature of the types of plumbing fixtures we have in the jail, they're not your typical what you'd see in your house, because the jail cells have their vacuum diaphragm operated valve, got a remote button in the cell for their sink, and when you push that button, it pulls a rubber diaphragm and then lets a predetermined amount of water run through. Well, the diaphragms are rubber, the body that they sit in is nylon, so the hard water deposits eat away at the rubber diaphragms, and then over time will potentially eat away at the nylon valve body. So I think, you know, just to kind of put it in perspective, there's 41 cold water sink valves and 41 hot water sink valves. And then showers have the same basic valve in it, but they have mixed water, so there's only one valve per shower, and there's 16 of those. Huh. And that's just in the jail cells. And then you add in kitchen equipment, you know, booster heater on your dish machine, get hard water deposits in that, so you shorten the life expectancy of that dish machine. So I think without the soft water, you could look at, you know, minimum $3,000 worth of extra repair costs per year. So I think money well spent in having soft water at the facility. And the new, more modern ones are more efficient, so we'd have a reduced cost in salt, which is about $100 a quarter we spend on salt for the current system.
Yeah, so this is one of those areas that you know, you look at our buildings, and it's hard to believe that this one's 50 years old, and the Justice Center is coming up on 20 years old, and back in the jail, you know, those are dog years back in the jail as far as the kind of wear and tear that a building takes. And so we're going to have some of these. We're seeing it with some of our heat pumps. We're now seeing it with the water softener. We're going to see more of this as we go. Questions for Joby about the water softener?
Cost of ownership, you're going to go have, everything's got a life cycle. We're at the end on this one. It is just what we need to do because Nevada water is historically not easy on things, and it is not the best tasting water you're going to find stored down either.
Yep, it runs low, about 12 grains per gallon of hardness. Yeah. Soft water is between 0 and 1. So it's better than it used to be.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
We significantly use it.
We far less salt in the problem here.
We did. Sure. We first opened the facility.
Well, and the fact that you know, or I guess it's not a fact, your note that you would expect about $3,000 additional repair costs every year if we don't have the water softener. And I would assume that doesn't include our staff time to get in there and replace that stuff.
That doesn't include man hours.
Makes a pretty quick payback on something like this. Laura's questions?
None.
Let's make a motion.
I move consideration of the purchase of the new 85-gallon water softener from Kineco, installed and disposal from Justice Center for $15,000 by facilities. Management has presented.
I second.
Motion and a second. Further discussion? Chief?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Buy a new water softener, Joby.
Okay, will do.
Now let's talk about a truck. Next item on the agenda, discussion consideration of purchase of a 2018 Ford heavy-duty pickup.
Yes, this 17-7. Is one we had an FY19. You guys, board requested to move it into 18, so we went ahead and got sent out some bids for it. Received two back. Got one from George White Chevrolet and one from Ames Ford, and so I recommend going with the lower bid from Ames Ford. And then included with on top of this, we need about an additional $2,000 worth of accessories for running boards, tonneau cover, gooseneck hitch in the back, wiring for our dump trailers, and then there will be additional cost for the snowplow equipment, but we can't get that until we're into FY19. They don't have any on hand. They won't be ordering any till, so we'll just wait on the snowplow stuff until closer to fall.
And this won't put you short. So how long does it take from the time we approve this to actually get the truck in hand?
It should be here in about 6 weeks, according to Ames Ford.
Okay, so the truck we're replacing is still operational.
Yes.
It's just time for it to go.
It's 10 years old. It's in pretty rough shape.
Sure.
You know.
And so just a note for anybody watching or listening who doesn't follow that closely, our activities when it comes to budgeting, what happens for the last few years is as we go through the budgeting process for the upcoming year, we take a look at what kind of equipment requests we've got coming, in this case for FY19. And if we feel like we're in a good fiscal position for the rest of 2018, we try to pull a few of those key items, in this case a truck that we would buy in 2019, pull it forward into 2018 and do it, frankly, while we're in great position fiscally. We know what this year looks like. And so that's what's happening here. This is a piece of equipment that was scheduled to be bought this fall. And now we're going to try to pull it into this spring with money that we have remaining in this year's budget. Anything to add on? Well, I just think it's important to note that for everybody.
No, I mean, Toby did a very good job of making us aware that we had a truck that was starting to fail. I mean, at least a hard life. It's exposed to all the salt that we put out, and it does a lot of heavy hauling. It's not going to last forever, and I think we should be pleased with the fact we got 10 years out of it.
I do have a question about the vehicle quote.
Sure.
The county discount shown here is $13,119. If that's correct. All right.
Yes.
So, what is a county discount?
Well, I think it's the way I understand it. It's a set like government pricing for vehicles. You know, we have that on various other types of things that we buy, like our department, you know, like tires. You know, we have government pricing on tires. It's just a kind of set.
Okay.
I think that's more the dealership's code to get us to that government price.
All right, thank you. I don't think I've seen it that.
Yeah, so that's not anything that Story County has negotiated with.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Anything else? If not, I take a motion.
I would move that we purchase the 2018 4x4 standard cab 3/4-ton heavy duty pickup truck for the net price after trade-in of $17,796 out of the fiscal year 18 budget.
I would second.
From
motion and a second. You need to trade in the Explorer and get one of these. You look good driving one. anything additional? Any other thoughts?
No.
Olson.
Aye.
Chee.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Thanks, Jody.
Thank you.
That takes a lot for you. Next is consideration of resolution 1881, approving technical assistance to communities for fiscal year 2018. Leanne, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Leanne.
This is one of my favorite programs that we do. How many years have we been doing it now?
Well, it started in 2013. It was when the initial resolution was adopted. And what this program is eligible communities that are under 3,000 persons in population.
Which is everybody except?
Except for Ames, Story City, Nevada, and Huxley. It was a geography quiz.
That was.
Thank you. There are 10 eligible communities then. They can receive up to $3,000 for funding for technical assistance. Everything from updating a comp plan to bringing an engineering firm in to help with some speculative buildings, whatever it may be. It's been kind of open-ended in that regard. So just some quick statistics. In 2013, was the first program, we had 8 of the 10 communities participating for $23,000 thereabouts in funding. 2014, I think it was the same 8 communities participate again. It was $20,000. The difference being the second year we dropped it down to $2,500 rather than $3,000. Year 2015, it dropped down to 4 of the 10 communities, so around $11,000 in funding. We did not run in 2016. These are the kind of outcrop of budget discussions. There's a theme going on this morning. Budget discussions and see if there's some room left in the general fund dollars to really engage communities in participating in this. So that's why you see me coming in February each year. Last year we did run in again, had 4 of the 10, and it was about $10,000. I've already heard a couple of inquiries. Are you going to do this again? So the resolutions before you is going back up to the $3,000 level. And then I have a letter that I'll send out along with the application form. Program would essentially start today, but it could go back to projects that started at the beginning of the fiscal year. So going back to July 1st of 2017. All projects would have to be finalized, completely done by June 30th of this fiscal year. They have until June 1st, though, this fiscal year to submit the reimbursement request. Are there any questions?
When you go out and provide assistance to communities, that is not included in the $3,000,
no.
Correct? So they can still, based on, like, if you do workshops and they decide to go in and hire somebody then to carry forward on some comprehensive planning, the $3,000 would go for that instead.
Well, I mean, if, I'm not going to say Maxwell will do this, but I'm currently working with Maxwell, City Maxwell and Conklin. They had an engineering firm as well, doing a lot of the background mapping too, in addition to what Story County is providing. So this could essentially maybe cover that cost too. I'm not having conversations with the mayor. I don't know if that's their intention.
Right.
But yeah.
It's a great point for us. I mean, it's I think right to note that this isn't the only thing we do with the communities. I mean, in addition to this, we've run multiple Main Street projects and different revitalization efforts. I just happen to think that this is as important. If you trace it back to 2012 and when we instituted this program, what we saw was most of our smaller communities had not, for a multitude of reasons, but had not kept their ordinances up to date, had not put together strategic plans, had not generated the necessary infrastructure to be able to apply for grants and different opportunities that come along to our smallest towns. And what we've seen since this, I mean, go to Zeering, go to Collins, go to Maxwell. Take a look at what some of these communities have done, not because of this, but this has been a necessary component to them being able to do some of the other things they've done. It's the reason I refer to this as one of my favorite things that we do. We're spending, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 a year, but really giving our smaller communities an opportunity to put themselves, put their best foot forward.
Thank you.
And kind of an interesting side product is we get copies of all the documents. And we had an instance where there was a staff turnover and actually leadership turnover in a community where we were in a meeting, Marty will recall this, with this community. I'm like, well, have you looked at your capital improvements plan? We don't have one. Like, well, yeah, you do. And I had the copy, which they actually did not know about, so that they were able to take that and really run with it then and help, as you said, Rick, apply for a grant then. So it's kind of that side product that is actually helping the communities.
Super. Other questions or comments?
I would tell Loris just through this discussion, you're going over to COLA this afternoon for the economic development. I would be, you know, discussing this component with them too, because just came out, Mike Cox and Nick Laney and I were at the COLA meeting here Wednesday night, and Leanne's name came up in this capacity, and it was at a Maxwell City Council meeting, and Leanne's name came up in this capacity. So the counties, our smaller communities are aware that we host and maintain a resource for them, and that they know that if need be that they can call on. I see this clearly as a success, and we encourage that we continue to do it.
Mm-hmm. I'd take a motion to that effect.
Then to that end, move some papers around.
I would move resolution 1881 as presented.
Second.
We got a motion and a second for resolution 1881 offering technical assistance to our communities for the remainder, and it's important to note this, remainder of this fiscal year. So everything has to be done by the end of June 2018. So time is of the essence. Further discussion?
None.
Olson?
Aye.
Cheney?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Resolution 1881 passes. Next is discussion consideration of amendments to the administrative procedures for floodplain management and regulation. Leanne, again.
Switching hats. This is actually a requirement of participating in the National Flood Insurance Program. Several criteria. When we have adopted regulations, you have an individual assigned to enforce those adopted regulations, and then you have administrative procedures. It's generally understood that on a every 2 year basis, these get reviewed and cleaned up. Did that in 2016, but wasn't really necessary to make any changes at that point. So I'm coming back with you at this point with some changes. I'm going to just go through them quickly. I did have some Jerry Moore, Planning Development Director, offer some feedback too, which I'm greatly appreciative of, and I'll share that as we go to it. Please stop me with any questions. These are used internally by staff. There's really not out there for the general public to follow it. I mean, once we get them polished and the website up to date, we'll get them back out there. But the meat of the meat of what the public really needs to be familiar with is regulations, and that's Chapter 80 of the floodplain of the Code of Ordinances. But they do go hand in hand. Just starting on page 1, on the section 3.0, I do add section L, serving as the community rating system, CRS coordinator. That's now, since these are last reviewed and adopted, a responsibility that lies with the floodplain manager, as we are a CRS community. Next page, again, I'm going to just give you some highlights. Under section 4.3, the permit application submittal and review process, actually just kind of organizing it a little bit better. This language wasn't really, didn't flow nicely. You had to kind of figure out where you were. So just adding that. Jerry did ask whether or not it would be appropriate to add a time frame for review of typical projects, a typical time frame. We do that with kind of the outreach component too. I don't know if it's appropriate to put in here. For one, I don't want to say this type of application can take 2 weeks. This type can take 3 days. This can take several months. Each floodplain permit application is unique and kind of stands on its own. So at this point, I'm kind of hesitant to add that at this point into the regulations or into the administrative procedures and just really do it for the outreach component. But I'll leave that for your discussion as well. I do note that section 4.4 on page 5 is moved up under the whole application review procedures, the inspections.
Okay.
and then added the final development permit issuance. For whatever reason, that had never made its way into the whole administrative procedure. So the process is you get the application, review it, do a preliminary inspection, issue a pre-construction phase permit. They do the work. That's good for a year. They do the work, go out, do final inspection, and issue a final permit. That final permit step was never included, but it's always, since we adopted the floodplain management program in 1983, it's been that way. So for whatever reason. And then going on to page 6, under the enforcement chapter, adding a reference to code of ordinances, just so that we have that out as common knowledge. Under section 6, variances and appeals, just clarifying again that the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has to approve a variance as well, and that's in the code of ordinances too. Jerry did question which kind of came first, chicken or the egg concept. Really, we do it on our end, and then we send it to the DNR. And the DNR, it, regardless, kind of, even if we approve it, they still have the trump card.
Kind of like a CAFO application?
Yeah. In 20 years here, we've only had two variances, and both were denied by our Board of Adjustment anyway. So I think that speaks well of the program itself, too, that, you know, we work with the applicant. One was for a chicken coop, and the chicken coop was not allowed in the floodway in any way. So that was kind of a fun moment, actually. Page 7, under records, just clarifying that all of our records are digital format. And that's actually necessary to have in here. Especially in the SPRS community, we need to have that noted that we don't have paper records. Our official records are digital, which is, again, our standard practice. I do want to point out Section 8. I am recommending an increase in our fees. They've been kind of static for the past 5 or 6 years. We actually lowered them substantially, cut them in half, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago. The structural permit was $200. Per parcel, and the non-structural is $100 per parcel. We cut them down to $100 and $50, and actually they were not included in here, so I'm recommending one including them in here and then increasing them each $50 for structural and $25 for non-structural, so $150 per parcel and $75 per parcel.
Where are these fees placed when they're collected?
It goes to planning and development.
Okay.
And it's funneled through that off as a revenue for planning and development. So it goes to the rural fund, Marty.
Thank you.
Again, it doesn't come close to covering staff time. And that's always the goal, though, that we try to get as close as we can.
Yep.
So, other than that, I do recommend removing Section 12 stream bank stabilization measures. We put these in several years ago as really a reminder to staff when we're looking at stream bank projects. We need to make sure we have certain conditions of approval that are noted. We're there. I mean, this staff member knows that these all had to be standard conditions of approval. They really should not be in our administrative procedures. So I'm recommending taking those out as well.
Could we go back to number 9? And I just have a question about, we've stricken in A and B and C, we've stricken ordinance and said regulations instead. So I was just wondering, you know, have we had an ordinance and we've canceled it, or did we have a wrong reading?
We have the ordinance and the code of ordinances, but it's called floodplain management regulations. Is how the chapter's entitled. And so it's just kind of semantics.
Okay.
So now I'm moving to 12, back to 12. So I get that you know this stuff like the back of your hand, but our plan is to have others stepping in and doing some of the floodplain work. Are they going to have it like the back of their hand, and is it appropriate for them to have a cheat sheet to go to?
That's a good question, and I understand. I think maybe rather than being in the administrative procedures, we have a standardized list of conditions based on type of permits. And
I'm fine with that. I just don't want anything to get lost in the shuffle. So right now you're handling 100% of these. We're hoping we're going to get to a point that you're not handling 100% of these.
And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to have, so each each time I issue a permit, there are really some standard conditions that go with each permit. You know, but then there are some that are specific for erosion control, for bridges and culverts. So I'm starting to set up templates for each of those types of permits so we don't have to reinvent the wheel each time. So at such time, responsibilities are go to a different party, those permit will all go with them. And it seems awkward to have these in the administrative procedures.
Yes.
However, okay, playing a little bit of the other side here, okay. So if we want to provide the most informative information up front, you know, good customer service, and someone who was looking at applying for a permit wanted to see the administrative rules, would it not be helpful for them to see there's quite, you know, there's A through G here in 12, to see these before they go ahead and see them on the conditions, but know that these might be applicable up front?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. The only thing I would note is item G that you just pointed out, we had A through G. Item G is other information that may be required by the floodplain manager, so it's kind of an open-ended deal anyway, and I would prefer, so this is just me, as long as we have a mechanism for whoever's doing the inspection to be consistent, it shouldn't matter whether you have Leanne or somebody else doing it, you should be held to the same standard. I want a consistent standard. As long as we can get that through our procedures, then maybe it's not necessary here. I'm fine with either. I like the idea of simplifying wherever possible, and this looks to me like simplifying this one, because it's really an internal, as I'm understanding it, an internal kind of thing that our floodplain manager needs to be making sure they're getting all this stuff.
Yeah, and there's, that goes along with all this, there's a checklist, there's standard operating procedures, obviously the application form, which I'll talk about next, but I mean there's a whole wealth of other information that goes along with the floodplain management program in addition to the procedures and the regulations themselves. Not even talking about the community rating system, too. That's it.
Boris makes a good point, I guess, that you can't, as an applicant, would make the self-education as to what they can expect to go through. I don't see this as a bad thing, but the thing is that we are still going to be placing it. The redundancy to me is just like, well, I get why if it's going to be over here, why do you need it over here?
I
get your point, Lars.
I think it'd be worthwhile to doing a pamphlet on stream bank stabilization. There's different types of riprap we will and will not accept. I think that'd be useful to have.
I agree, and I think I know the outreach coordinator might be part of that. Huh? So I think that's a great idea. So as long as we have the information available.
So did that cover it for you, or you're okay with 12 coming out?
I'm good.
So then 13 becomes 12.
And then actually the date would be the 20th and the 21st effective date, because I was reading the ordinance itself. It actually has to be adopted by resolution. I had forgotten about that. So
yep.
I'll bring back a resolution
next week
and just on consent. But I just wanted to get this in front of you because actually the three of you have never seen this. Rick, you've seen it, but I mean,
right. This
current board has not. Any other questions on the necessary procedures?
So no action necessary today. You'll bring it back to us in the form of resolution next week.
The floodplain permit application, I just wanted to spend a moment. This is not for your, this is an internal operating, you know, at staff approval level, what forms the applications we use. But I am taking the step to try and get it look really similar to what planning development has for their forms. Actually, Stephanie Jones with Planning Development gave me their template, so I was able to really add this to that, so it just has a similar look and feel.
Outstanding. Good. Any questions, board?
Huh?
All right, so we'll look for the resolution next week, Leanne. Thank you.
Can you guys approve the changes?
And would you have it as a consideration?
Well, I don't think we want to approve the changes today, since we got it coming forward in resolution, and we'll adopt the whole dang thing then.
You could accept the changes and direct staff to come forward with resolution next week.
I'm fine with that.
I move that we accept the changes as presented and ask the staff come forward next Tuesday with a resolution for us to approve the new regulations.
Second.
Motion and a second. Further discussion.
None.
Holson.
Aye.
Chee.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Changes are approved, but we'll look for the resolution in order to formalize it. Next is departmental reports, and we have conservation with Mike Cox today.
Hi, Mike.
Welcome back, Mike.
Hi. Good morning again.
Hey, if you don't have as part of your report to us today, tell us about your day yesterday.
Sure. So I'll just start out with that then. So yesterday, let's see, I believe there were 8 folks from Story County that went down, and not necessarily Story County proper, but 8 folks from the county that went down to the Capitol to talk about funding the Outdoor Recreation Natural Resource Trust Fund, a.k.a. IWIL. And something that we've been working on, we, and when I say that, conservation community in the state has been working on for a number of years, ever since it was approved back in 2010. So been working on a number of years to urge our legislators to go ahead and pass that and fund a trust fund. Hasn't happened yet. Obviously, there was a good turnout yesterday. Several hundred people there from all over the state, and had some good conversations with our legislators about it. Continue to have those conversations, and hopefully we can find an end to this and get it funded.
I'm hearing now, Mike, and I'd be interested to see what you heard yesterday, that all of a sudden there seems to be a little momentum around the concept of raising the state sales tax by 1 cent. Clearly, the first 3/8 of a cent would go to IWIL as required. Second 3/8 would go to mental health, and the final quarter would be some kind of income tax reduction. It is the conversation I'm hearing. In fact, I think the Des Moines Register just yesterday or the day before put out a poll results that showed 62% of Iowans would support that concept. It's got a near place in my heart because I'm the one who proposed it 3 years ago, and it went absolutely nowhere the first year, and then the second year it at least made it far enough to die at the state house, and then the next year it made it a little further, and now all of a sudden this year it feels like there's a little momentum behind it. Did you hear anything like that yesterday?
Well, I can say that I think the only momentum behind the trust fund is to wrap it into a tax reform discussion. And so, a.k.a. that kind of formula is I think the formula is going to happen in order to fund the trust fund this session. It's going to have to be wrapped into that.
And trust fund, what do we estimate is worth on an annual basis right now? Is it $150
million? $187 million annually.
So $187 million there, that would be $187 million in mental health, Marty, to fund all the regional, which means for a place like Story County, this year we're levying $2.2 million for mental health, but the reality is now at the $48 per capita limit, you're more like $5 million that Story County could be levying if we didn't have money in reserve. But now those property taxes would go away for all the counties, and then I had no idea what kind of concept they're talking about with that extra quarter cent.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But I do think in order for that to be, for IWIL to be successful this session, it has to be involved in that kind of greater tax reform discussion, which we think is going to happen.
So up till now, conservation directors collectively have been reluctant to support anything tag along with that. They want to, IWIL's already gone through, it's already in the Constitution, it already is sitting there, and it felt to me like, Mike, your statewide group kind of wanted to stay separate. Are you feeling now that your statewide group is ready to embrace kind of the whole package concept?
Yeah, absolutely. Given there's some hesitancies about discussions on formulas, there's a 27-member panel a number of years ago spent almost 3 years coming up with that, the formula that for IWIL that we have right now. And I think when that discussion moves forward with the legislature, there's going to be a lot of eyes on that formula, which is not in code. And so there's a fair amount of concern on that. There's a fair amount of concern on other bills that would essentially limit the ability or limit the palatability on the part of legislators to pass IWIL. So there's a little bit of, there's always that in the back of our minds. But yeah, moving forward, think that the coalition and the conservation community is all supportive of wrapping IWIL into tax reform.
Super. Well, let me know how I can be helpful. I'm on a statewide group trying to get that passed, so anytime I can be helpful.
And I think, you pointed out correct figures in that I think there have been two recent polls done. One was done at the very end of 17, and that showed 69% of Iowans are willing to pay that extra 3/8 of a cent to fund IWIL. And then the Des Moines Register poll that came out, which was 67 or 69%,
okay,
as well. So people want it, but the mention of any kind of new tax at the Capitol is always.
But maybe that's where an offset of other taxes might make it a little more palatable. We'll see.
Right.
All right. So I didn't mean to get us that far off track. Let's get into your report.
No, it's good. So. You may be aware that I guess toward the end of 17, the Conservation Board rewrote its strategic plan. So we have a 3-year strategic plan, and updated the last one. The last plan that we had was actually a 5-year plan, and it focused, it was a tremendous plan. It focused more on it kind of had a silo approach to how it was written with different departments or different units within the conservation department. And so this plan, we've really revamped that and looking at efforts that bring all of those together under common themes and give a tremendous amount of effort or focus on community engagement. We've always been strong, particularly through our environmental education program on community engagement. You know, we reach out to a lot of folks and have a lot of partners throughout the community. But we really need to continue to develop that as we move forward. So we actually rewrote our mission statement, and that doesn't happen very often. You can imagine when you rewrite a mission statement what that involves. Anyway, our new mission statement, connecting people with nature and improving natural resources. Making Story County a great place to live, work, and recreate. So, I haven't got that quite committed to memory yet. but anyway, that's our new mission statement. I think it's great. It encompasses what we try to do with the Conservation Board. So,
Board, we really need to stop right there and point out that so there were a lot of people that put in a lot of effort to getting this done and went above and beyond, and that's the entire Conservation Board, all of our conservation staff, many, many of the stakeholders involved in conservation, but we would really be remiss if we did not recognize the extraordinary efforts of Nancy Franz and Mike Cox to get this done. It's as good a strategic plan as any conservation unit and probably any governmental entity anywhere has. Took a lot of heavy lifting to get it done. So thank you, and I'll be sure to do this, but please pass on our thanks to Nancy especially.
I will. Thank you. Next on my list is the Tedesco Environmental Learning Corridor. Just to bring everyone up to date on that, as you know, we had construction for our Phase 1 project that is substantially complete now. It's not not closed out, but it is substantially complete. All the stream work has been done. All the grading work has been done. Best practices in the stream stabilization on the bank, all of that's been completed. We got that done at the very end of the year, and so we're now waiting on getting some final touches on some seeding, and then we're working with Ames Noon Rotary and a few other clubs to get some tree planting done that they've embraced, and so we plan to get that tree planting done this spring, and then that project will be wrapped up. So right on the heels of that is Phase 2 project, which is we're anticipating for this coming summer. We're in final stages of design on that. And we'll bring that forward on the 27th, I believe, of February to this board for consideration of releasing the request for bids at that time. So moving forward on that, and it's exciting. I hope to have that phase two then under contract and this spring, and then wrapped up this coming season. So phase two will be all of the trails, the gathering areas, kind of the meeting areas, all of the amenities that make it look like a park. The emphasis on phase one was all the grading work, the earth work, the stream work, and now we're making that look like a park. So that'll be nice. And then the next phase, the final phase in the project, will be that trail connection from the Tedesco Environmental Learning Core out to R38, which is about a 2.5 mile stretch of trail. Mm-hmm. Those are the final pieces, and that's how it's progressing. Questions about that one?
So there's not a week that goes by that I don't get stopped by multiple people who want to talk to me about Tedesco and what they're seeing. In fact, I was stopped last night by a gentleman who works in the research park. His office actually has windows looking out over the research park, and he said, I am amazed. He said, I've worked there for 10 years, and I never knew there were houses, right? There's two houses on the east side, and there's one house on the west side. Never knew there were houses in there. I mean, it was the most dense, unattractive and unenvironmentally friendly kind of landscape that could be there. And the work that's been done so far, I jokingly said, you know, the whole project now is Rufus approved. Rufus being my little Jack Russell Terrier. Rufus has been out there and smelled every inch of it, and he thinks it's pretty good.
We try to keep Rufus happy.
That's right. Stamp of approval.
Very good. Appreciate it. Heart of Iowa Nature Trail improvements, I want to bring that up next. Last fall, we did, toward the end of the year, we met with all the cities along the corridor, along the trail. So that includes Slater, Huxley, Cambridge, Maxwell, and Collins. So met with those folks, had a real good turnout, and discussed next steps. So discussed moving forward. You all know we've chatted about paving, and so that was the impetus of our meeting. And then to hear what those cities or what those communities are doing in relation to trail related projects. The outcome of that was essentially, kind of tacit agreement, concurrence on moving forward with paving from Slater to the east, and doing it in a sequential manner. To that end, we have requested a SERPTA grant for $300,000 that will help us address that first section. That's been submitted, and we will be submitting a couple other grant requests as well for those. We're holding on a couple of grant opportunities until we get to that next stage, until we get to the Huxley to Cambridge section. So we've got a couple of opportunities that we're identifying as potential funders for that. We're moving forward we'll be under contract soon for a design firm on doing that first phase of the project, again from Slater to, it'd actually be to 535th Street, and then we need to figure out how we're going to connect that trail then up to 320th, is that right? The blacktop that goes from R38 into Huxley. Mm-hmm. So,
Mike, since the trail is already there, we're looking at Cambridge instead. Is there any hope or possibility that it won't be $400,000 a mile, but it could be under that?
Absolutely. Oh. Absolutely. That's our hope.
Okay.
We're going to know a lot more getting through this stretch. So we estimated it early on at $400,000 a mile. But, Laura, if you correctly know, we're hoping that that includes the entire build out of the trail, and maybe we've got a good enough base to get by.
And it's so dependent on what that base is, what the water conditions, the drainage conditions are like. this first section is probably is going to be the most cost-effective section we have.
Right.
Moving further to the east, then we start to, you know, the Huxley to Cambridge section has some drainage issues right around the interstate, so that'll add to our cost a little bit. And then once we get from Cambridge to Maxwell, there's some significant drainage issues there. Problem areas that we've had disaster funding for in the past and continue to have, you know, local funding to help address those. So those are some problem areas that we'll get into. But this first section is essentially it's a level area. It's high. There's not a lot of drainage concerns. We expect this will be the least expensive of the sections of the trail to do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, our hope is it comes in well under that.
Okay. Thanks.
And, Mike, as you note, the section going really from Huxley over to Cambridge, we've got the one stretch right there, it's 560th, where the road curves, and it's kind of a funky crossing that we have on 560th. So we have a conversation, a workshop later today with our county engineer talking about our five-year road plan. 560th is currently part of that five-year road plan. It's going to make a lot of sense that at least in terms of that crossing and probably a little bit of the trail on either side of that crossing, that we work hand in glove to make sure that we're maximizing any dollars that might be spent in that corridor, doing the road, making the crossing a little better. So just stay aware of what's going on there.
Yeah. Anything we can count toward local contributions when we move forward with other grant requests and that. We chatted about Prairie Rail Trail project. I'd be very happy when we get this one wrapped up. We want to give a lot of thanks to Ethan to help and sort through this project. It's been pretty intricate in how we approach it, and so I'm very thankful for Ethan and the county attorney's office for helping sort through that. Next project I wanted to chat about just briefly is Jordan Wildlife Areas. That has been a fairly big project for us over the last couple years. We have not closed on that yet. But we anticipate to close on that, i.e. acquire that property this summer. It'd be early this summer is our thought. Again, that's that project that we spent minimal local funds in bringing that forward. All in all, that project cost probably just shy of $900,000. And we're going to see a tax contribution of probably about $20,000 that goes toward that. So I wish we could do a lot more projects like that.
And just hit on how many direct acres is this, and then the indirect acres that come into public access because of this.
Yeah, so this property is 175 acres, and after we started down the road of trying to acquire this and making it a wildlife area, the neighboring landowners got involved and decided that they should take some areas out of production, flood prone areas out of production, and put them into conservation programs. So I won't say solely as a result of our project, but I think that brought the discussion to light, or brought the idea to light with some neighboring landowners. And so about 500 additional acres have in the floodplain have gone into a conservation program right around the Jordan Wildlife Area.
Yeah, it's a great success story. And just to underscore, about 20,000 taxpayer dollars in this, what's going to be, end up, all said and done, be close to $1 million project.
Correct.
So
local taxpayer dollars.
Mm-hmm. Local, yeah, correct. Yeah, local.
Which is our primary concern.
That's right. I just because they don't, somebody will come back in and say, but you got it.
You're absolutely right. Next project that I think you guys are aware of, but the Hickory Grove Park project, the lake renovation there. We've been working on this for a number of years also. I won't go into all the details on there. In short, contract for phase one has been secured, has been signed, and those folks are waiting to or weather conditions to get on board. Phase one is some stream bank, or excuse me, some shoreline stabilization and some gully mitigation, some gully stabilization. So that will happen as soon as weather permits. Phase two is putting the pipe in. And so phase two is, I'm going to say we're about 90% design on that, and that's moving forward. Expect to have a contract for that this spring and bring that to this board for then our agreement with DNR, who's coordinating that effort. So to provide the sign the agreement with DNR for our local match on that, which is 25% of the overall costs. So that's moving forward. I want to thank Marty for going to the Colo City Council meeting and continues to represent County and Conservation Board on a sewer solution for Hickory Grove. I think that there's some starting to see some real synergy developing there, and really excited about that. We hope that we can get a solution that just works best for not just the park, but that area and the county in general. And we think that there's some real potential for co-oping with the city. So I don't know, Marty, if you wanted to add any more to that.
I was going to wait until we got to our liaison assignments. But to that end, it was almost a three-hour meeting. Mike and I, and surprisingly enough, Sergeant Nick Lenny stayed for the entirety of it. And you would expect Mike to speak, you know, knowledgeably about it. I was more there on just a proposal basis. But Sergeant Lenny, who is a resident of rural Colo and a camper, spoke to the fact on a need basis of what, I guess, because there's only 44 spots in Hickory Grove, that if you're not prepared to go on a Tuesday, place your camper there, pay through the weekend, you're not going to get a spot. And so the city council was in rapt attention as Mike spoke to what they, on a proposal basis, because they were trying to tease out all the details. Now, whether or not we can get to a point where the city of Colo has comfort in us moving our septic to them or not, that's going to be, we'll talk more about that here coming up. But I think that they see the economic benefit. They like what they were told. I think you have a forward-leaning group likely to act upon it and want to find out whether this is a yes or no, as opposed to the esoteric discussions that we've had. So, Mike, good on Mike, good on Sergeant Lenny, and I just sat there and watched them perform.
Yeah, and so I want to note two things. First of all, thank you, Marty, for attending that and encourage it. It's time for us to get to the end of this one. It's time. I mean, hopefully it's going to be a yes that we can do it because it's the best answer for Hickory Grove, but it's time to get to a yes or a no. And Marty, so appreciate you attend. I think it's really important that we note that Supervisor Olson also planned on attending that meeting. She views it as something really, really important, rightly so, and did not attend, and I don't want to overstate this, Lord, but did not attend because I asked you not to attend simply because I had concerns about potential open meeting violations. So just note for everybody, Laura was planning on being there, would have been there, but didn't because I asked her not to. So thank you.
Good. Very good. So we're starting to see some more positive energy and our outlook on the solution of the Colo is improving. Next project, Carroll Prairie, is another small acquisition that we've kind of had on the books for a while. It came on about the same time as Jordan, and frankly, my response to one of our partners in the agency in this was, yeah, I really don't want to add this to the books right now because we're engaged in Jordan. And once we get completed with Jordan, then let's chat. So they moved forward and bought the property and without any kind of guarantee or obligation from us. And so we're very, very pleased that happened the way it did. And so now it's time, and they've been, this is Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, and they've been raising funds to essentially pay back their line of credit on their acquisition of the property. Then once that's done, it'll come over to county ownership. About 80% of the required funding has been secured with very little effort on our part. And so, again, really appreciative of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. They're the same agency that we worked with on Jordan Wildlife area, and we worked with them for throughout the years on different acquisition projects. Super asset for us. So we expect that, say, within the next year, that funding will be completed. Let's see, sensitive areas inventory. We completed the first season of field work for that. Have a little bit more to do this year. We essentially contracted for about 5,000 acres to be surveyed. Of that first 5,000 acres, he was able to put feet on the ground on about 3,000, give or take. And about 2,000, the landowners for about 2,000 of those acres denied our request to do the inventory. And so we continue to move forward. Now he's doing some of the next level of inventories, and he'll be working on that through this spring, and then we'll chat about, per our budget discussions, then we'll chat about having the continuing that for additional acreage.
Mike, can you recap what the objections were from the 2,000 people, or did they just give a flat no?
Not 2,000 people.
Oh, sorry, 2,000 the owners of the 2,000 acres. Sorry.
So it varies. It varies. Some people is just, you know, just don't want anyone else on the property. That's the majority of it. People that just don't agree with having anyone else, let alone government. Or any representation thereof on the property, and that's fine. What we did find out was that a lot of those landowners that did allow the inventory really appreciated it, and they spent added time with our folks in the field. And so we had top-notch botanists out there doing this work, and so they educated a lot of landowners on what those landowners have on their property as far as plant communities and ecological communities. So there was a lot of outreach done in this project, and frankly, I think we more was done than what any of us anticipated. And so that's kind of an added benefit of it, but also an added cost because it came with their, you know, our contractor's time. But tremendous response to it.
If you get these same people that are not going to like hunters, they're not going to allow hunting.
Right.
They're not going to allow recreational vehicles on their ground, and they're not going to allow botanists on their ground.
Well, and you add one thing to that. So a huge majority, I think, of the individuals that said, no, you can't come on, were just that. They just don't want anybody on their property. But then there was a kind of a subset of those who get afraid when government is going in and doing an assessment at what is the second shoe that drops. So you tell me now I've got plant XYZ on my property, and now you're going to tell me how I have to manage it and things like that. So multifaceted, but I think we got a more favorable response than we ever expected.
Correct. And we've always viewed this as how can we, once we know what's there, you know, how can we assist in enabling that, those landowners to take conservation efforts forward on their own properties? Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing that come to play as well, and pointing people towards some options for them to, whether it be to improve prairies, whether it be to do timber stand improvements, whatever it may be. But we're able to refer some people in the right directions for those added measures that maybe they didn't know were available to them.
You did a great job of talking me into the extra money during the budget workshop there about all the benefits of it. So once again, I'm looking forward to what comes out of it. It looks like it's going to be worth the money.
Very good. Watershed assessments. Leanne and I were working with EOR, the firm that's doing the countywide watershed assessments, and expect to have that draft report back. I'm going to say in March, the end of this month or first part of March when we'll get that draft back.
Yeah. Speaking of somewhere we spend a little extra money, one right after the other. That's right. Well,
there you go. So look forward to that as a starting place for continuing discussion about what are appropriate next steps.
Yeah, and Board, I just want to underscore that because so we're going to get this report sometime in the next 30 to 60 days. We need to be prepared pretty quickly, I believe, to start to have the conversation. Okay, now we have the information, whatever it says to us. Now, what are we going to do, or at least what process are we going to go through to decide what we're going to do with that information? Because this is going to be one of those things that if it goes on a shelf somewhere and we say, hey, we did this great study, it's going to be meaningless to us. We've got to rapidly move into, okay, what are we going to do with this information? So just be prepared for that as we have the conversation.
I would ask that it not be on the March 14th or 13th.
Yeah, we'll make sure. Okay. We're going to hold that March 13th while you're not here. So we've got an issue in that March 6th is going to be a restricted agenda. So we're going to have some things that we're going to have to deal with on March 13th. Just rest assured, it's not our intent to put anything in there that you don't get to speak to.
I appreciate that.
And how we're hoping to handle that, actually not even bring it to a formal board meeting, have a work session where Pat comes with the board of the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Conservation Board as well. So all three entities get it through a work session format.
I think it makes a lot of sense.
Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about our environmental education program. You know, they were named, we were named the best environmental education program in the state.
Right.
Again.
Named the best. Absolutely.
So we were named this in 2012, and now again for 18. So it's incredible. It's incredible.
And that speaks directly to the quality of staff we have and the passion that they have for environmental education. Loris, I know you spend a lot of time out there. Marty, I know you spend a substantial amount of time with them. Mike, just exceptional individuals with a real passion for what they're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Incredible group that we have. And as you're aware, we've had one naturalist recently named top front-end interpreter, i.e. the top one-on-one interpreter in the whole country. And just recently, and that's incredible. And then to have that followed right on its heels because we're the best program in the state. Kudos goes to those staff. And very little from me involved there. It's their creativity. You don't have to look very far beyond this calendar of events. Okay, this doesn't talk about the school programs. These are just the public programs. School programs go on and on. But look at some of the things, the programs that they come up with. And no one has ever accused our naturalists of not being creative and energetic. And so that's just incredible. To that end, last year we did what we call a Master River Stewardship Program. It's a multi-session course that folks take. And then they're certified as a master river steward at the conclusion of that. And then there's a service learning component that goes along with that. This year we're expanding on that, and the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute is a partner with us in that right now. And so we'll be offering, kind of instead of a traditional one-part classroom and some field trip session, we're going to offer a lab component that goes with that. And so we'll be able to get people some more hands-on in the field, and it'll be an option for, in other words, you don't have to take both the lab and the classroom. It'll be optional, but be a nice improvement and addition to an already outstanding program. So only other thing, and I know I went on and Joby left, but I want to comment on facilities management on their efforts in the Conservation Center, and it's just been incredible. the level of service that we get from facility management, and their dedication to the facility, and it's just been really nice to see, and great folks to work with, so we really appreciate their efforts out there.
I think that's so appropriate, Mike. It's amazing to me, as much time as I spent out at McFarland, to watch that facility, which was starting to show its age, well, it was more than starting to show its age, it was absolutely showing its age, to watch it start to be revitalized. And I know it's a combo of your staff, but also largely facilities coming in and really taking that on. We had so much deferred maintenance out there at McFarland, and to watch Joby and his staff eat away at those things, really, really positive outcome, and turning that building more into what you see from the rest of the county buildings where they're so well maintained. And so I've been appreciative that we've been able to move in that direction. I know it's costing us just a little bit more to do it that way, but we're definitely getting something out of it.
Right.
That's questions for Mike.
Do you know now that we've approved the additional carpeting and changeouts, do you have a more of a firm timeline when that's going to happen?
No, I'd have to refer that to Joby. I know that we went through it. I know they've got some preliminary costs on that. I'm not sure of where we sit.
We approved it last week, and so now it's a scheduling issue.
Okay.
Now it's just a scheduling issue. Right. Okay.
Yeah,
I just didn't know that because that was the holdup, because they did not want to be in the situation you were having an event there where they had the installers were going to come that night or whatnot. So I guess I didn't know if anything a week's time changed. So.
Yeah, Joby's working with conservation staff to find a hole where nothing's going on out there for a couple of evenings, and they'll try to get it done. So, Mike, thank you so much for the job you do, man.
Thank you.
We're lucky to have you. Public forum number two, opportunities for members of the public to address anything you want to address. Anybody wishing to do so, come on up. Seeing no one moving the microphone, liaison assignments, I think, Marty, you get to go first this week. Such an honor.
Pick up on the Hickory Grove conversation. Pretty robust. I think Laura's probably going to have an opportunity to speak to it too this afternoon. She's going to Colo. But I was there. I was asking if I asked my city to place me on the agenda so we can speak about the issue of the septic into their system. They're going to have to do an engineering analysis of their water, wastewater, and their stormwater, because they identified a field tile that was getting a lot of inflow, but by the time they fixed it, it stopped raining last year, so they don't really have flow numbers that they have comfort. I thought that on a partnership basis that we would not be, the expectation is we wouldn't be looking to have some contribution towards the offset of the cost of doing that engineering study. And so the proposal is that they bring it back to themselves, as they took the information. It was nothing more than a discussion point, no action was taken. And that the comfort was that as I told them when I left the meeting on Wednesday night, I will bring that back to this board, informing us that we have probably the likelihood of a partnership forming that could give us a technical answer to whether this is a go or a no-go.
But that will be, in your estimation, Marty, that will be based on a request by them?
They will have to move on it themselves before it comes back to us.
So we've got nothing until they balls in their court.
This is nothing more than the fact that we have moved it. Mike and I have gone probably two, maybe three meetings there just to have the conversations, like what would it take to have us get to the point of we could hook up? And it just said to me that we need to move it to the tangible. And that was just asking them to talk it amongst themselves. I wanted a sounding where they were. They gave it. I'm bringing it back to you saying that that was a positive takeaway. They are going to bring it back to themselves next month as an action item, I expect. And then the proposal would be that they would want to join with us to do an engineering study of their water system.
Perfect. Anything else?
Fair Board met with them last night. We had, in the discussions we had with them, they were appreciative of the fact that we were listening to them when they made the presentation to us, so much so that as Ryerson's is vacating the facility out there, we saw the merit in taking on a sheltering basis our equipment that we set outside around this building. So on a going forward basis, the public will see less of that in our dump trailers, our skid loaders and whatnot, sundry equipment there. They were thankful that we made a small cash offering to help do the offset. This will use both roof space and electricity.
Rick, we talked about it here earlier. Loris, you have asked about it. The E911 board will act on our that component. That will be tomorrow night's meeting. I suspect that it will move. That means done. We know it needs done. And that all the discussions are taking place. Ames talks tonight. We spoke last week. E911 tomorrow night. Iowa State, I think, is just where they're at. Been dealing with a bunch of zoning requests.
I don't often do this, but here we go. You pick up today's Ames Tribune, and on the upper fold of the front page, you see an article today, an event that took place in Nevada yesterday. It involved our school district. We had a hostile threat called into it, and it caused us to go through a ALICE training outcome. We had taken that on ourselves on 2014, I believe, and implemented it shortly thereafter. And it caused a great lot of discomfort throughout the community, as you can well imagine. You know, not a small school district having to move both its middle school and its high school unplanned to safe locations. Now, I have always had a longstanding belief that the Ames Tribune has a commendable, informative, and supportable journalism. I had asked through correspondence with the author of the article that you see in yesterday's notice and today's paper, that there's a planning phase that goes through it, as we do with our COOP-COG, as we do on implementations of disasters that would find our county, well, the school districts, and I expect anybody that has gone through a ALICE training has a plan that comes out of that, how you move your students from a potential dangerous situation to a safe location. That's no small thing. You have to do that in cooperation with neighbors and the city, or both. And I understand that the Trib has an altruistic mission to inform its readership, but identifying the displacement sites that they did in today's paper comes with a great deal of discomfort in the fact that that was some information we would like to have had on a close hold. Now, I would think the likelihood that the Nevada schools is going to have to go back into a planning phase to adopt new sites, go through additional planning to have what they had thought would be something well thought out, well researched, and ready and available to use at a time in a distant future with the hope they never had to do it. Well, yesterday was that day. Now, I guess we will see what comes of that. And I just, having been part of the process of bringing ALICE training to the Nevada School District, implementing the process, and then seeing it play out, it was, I thought, as well as could have been done, and the great fortune that we had here in this community is that nothing came of it. Uh-huh. But because now everything's out of the barn, now I suspect the Nevada Schools is going to have to go back and do a retool. So I get it, I accept it, but those are the times we find ourselves in. And I'm done.
Well, thank goodness that nobody was injured and nothing came of the threat. And congratulations to the Bay School District for managing their plan and good luck in future planning efforts to all of them. Loris.
Yeah, thanks for that, Marty. With snow twice last week, some schedules got redone and rearranged. So this Thursday will actually be the Parenting Way discussion on the Boost Board. And once again, we're still $25,000 in dispute. And one of the latest documents I saw from the Parenting Way Board is now talking about even more confusion. I was more confused than when I read the auditor's report about some of these time cards and how they're being turned in. And this is a good example about so many people serve on volunteer boards. Thank you for people who do that. But it's a good example. It's okay to ask staff questions, okay, on all levels, because the staff should just have the answers, or you should want to know why they don't have the answers. So anyway, on that. I have an aging resources meeting this Thursday morning also.
Okay, your first one?
First one, and I have the orientation afterwards, and I was Marty dropped off four big white binders for me to look at before then, two of which are orientation binders. So
I have a collection. I have binders that I think go back to Jane Halliburton.
Okay.
I inherited almost a time capsule in some respect. I'm just kind of
thinning the herd, shall we say, and thank you for helping me.
If I'm not back by Friday.
That's a great group, but you may be there till Friday.
I think you'll enjoy this
meeting. So Herd has a small meeting scheduled for the same day. There's nothing on the agenda that I think is significant, and so I will be missing that. But right, if you want to drive all the way to Urbandale, you they think you're my alternate on it. So, yes, I am going to go tonight to the Economic Development Group in Colo just to hear an update about kind of what's going on there. Marty tends to be our primary person going there, but every once in a while it's good to hear.
See other faces.
Yeah, plus the fact that we want to go ahead and make sure that we're not having discussions that are going to come our way.
You have the ability to educate yourself in regards to what Colo has for a field tonight at 8 without me making an absolute proposal here, because we can't do that.
Right.
We wouldn't do that.
So that'll work out. So on Monday, I spent a lot of time in the morning talking about opioids. There was an opioid task force, and they have decided as a result of how well received the town halls were that they're going to try and set up a series of presentations, monthly discussion groups. So that'll be a couple months away. Also learned that there will be another physician getting certified in the county to administer the Suboxone. I'm sure I'm not saying it right. But anyway, it's one of the doctors over at the ISU Health Center. So students will have that, but there's still a push to have more physicians done. I had two interesting discussions that I'll bring back to you or refer as needed. I think one for you, Marty. I met with a member of our community who is a Muslim, and he wanted to discuss housing finance with me. I learned a lot about how some faiths view usury and how that stands in the way of them being able to finance housing, and how we would normally just go to a bank and borrow. So had a three-hour discussion with him. I'm going to refer that over to the Housing Trust, okay, just to let you know. And then the final one of discussion of note that I had this week is that still there's this YFS would like us to look at having some discussions on youth treatment for mental health in crisis other than just a physical crisis center. So I'm going to just go ahead and meet with Jason Hagelin to figure out more what he's thinking about, and then refer over to staff as I had referred the physical transition crisis center discussion. But I'm not even quite sure where they're headed. They did have a dedication for a new treatment program up in Mason City because they merged with the Francis Lauer Center up there. And so it sounds like the region's paying for mental health up there in that region, but we know that there's some financial issues with that region. So I will have that discussion, bring it back to everybody, and then refer it over to staff.
Super. So all right. Thanks, Loris. So the only thing I did, all my stuff got taken care of during our meeting today, but Marty, I did hear you mention that we had a meeting with Story County Farm Bureau Board.
Oh, yes,
this week.
Yes, we did.
So Story County Board of Supervisors traditionally has had a really interesting relationship with the Story County Farm Bureau Fair Board going back 20, 25 years. There, in fact, was about a five-year stretch where the Farm Bureau challenged the county's budget and, in fact, won a case in court where now Story County is the only county in Iowa that has to certify that we're using our rural property taxes appropriately, which we are. They seem to be really, really happy with what's going on in Story County. They like the balanced budget. They like the lower levy. They like that we're working on roads and bridges. I'd say it was me and Marty attending. We thought you were going to be at your Boost meeting that was canceled. Marty and I attended. Auditor Martin attended. And County Engineer Darren Moon attended. Normally Lisa Markley goes with us, but she's drinking margaritas in Arizona right now. So she somehow, while we were in the middle of a blizzard, she decided she was going to go to Arizona. I don't know
how for her part.
Anything else for the good of the order today? If not, I'd take a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned.